This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to the Q interview from CBC Podcasts and from Q on CBC Radio 1. Hello. How's it going? Welcome to the show. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for listening and all that. And also, I know I've been putting the shout out the past couple of weeks to rate and review and subscribe and all that. From what I've been told, it has been working. People seem happy. So I want to offer my gratitude, my thanks, and thank you for all the ratings and reviews especially. It actually means more than I thought. When in the past, when podcast hosts were like, well, you know, you should probably... should probably rate and review. I was like, yeah, right. I'm not going to do that. You can, I'm busy. And then turns out it makes a huge difference. And anyway, all that to say is thank you for doing that. Today on the show, I'm pretty excited about this one today. And we've been doing the show now. I've been the host of the show for, I want to say, round about 5 or 6 years now, give or take 5 or 6 years. And I've been looking forward to that whole time. And we've been, as a show, looking forward the whole time to getting to talk to Laverne Cox. Laverne Cox became incredibly famous and I would say groundbreaking as one of the stars of Orange is the New Black. And we have her today because she's here to talk about Inventing Anna. Have you seen this Inventing Anna show? It's based on this New York Magazine story about a woman in New York who is pretending to be rich and famous and ends up scamming a bunch of people. And what started as an incredibly gripping magazine story turned into a pretty unbelievable Netflix show. Laverne Cox plays a real-life celebrity trainer who's kind of sucked into Anna's world. And one thing we talk about, in addition to talking about the show and what is it about rich and famous people that's so alluring, I wanted to ask her, as an actor and a trans activist, can you be an actor without being a trans activist? Like, is there a separation between art and activism when it feels like so much of everything she does, even in the creative and artistic spaces, is framed as activism? And Laverne blew my mind with her answer to that. And one particular quote, which I'll give you right now, which is that the algorithm does not reward empathy. Empathy is not rewarded by the algorithm. And then at the end, we just talk about Wheel of Fortune. I had a dog named Vanna White, by the way. Laverne Cox stars in Inventing Anna. You can watch that on Netflix right now. Don't forget to hit like and subscribe and rate and review and smash the subscribe button. Here's my conversation with Laverne Cox. Laverne, how are you?
Hello. I'm exhausted. I'm fried. I'm just kind of like, you know, the caffeine. I feel like I'm on a like caffeine drip or something. And it's just like, you know, if I weren't, then I would just like sort of, you know. I'm really grateful, though, to be talking about this show and to have another show premiering. You know, it's just such a blessing.
I bet so. Well, listen, it's lovely to have you here. This show, Inventing Anna, is so amazing. And what's even more amazing about it is that it's based on a true story. How much of the story did you know before you were cast in the show?
Very little. I had just seen a news report, you know, I was like, the television was like on in the background or something. And I saw this, you know, fake heiress in court in handcuffs with these glasses. And I was sort of like, oh, that's wild. And then I just sort of went on with my life. And then Shonda Rhimes approached me and my team about potentially playing a role in her in the show. And then I think they sent me Jessica Pressler's article and I read it. And became obsessed. It's such a good read, and it's so well written, and it's so insane. And then I just sort of started reading everything I could about Anna and the circumstances surrounding her, her story. And then I started looking into Casey Duke, the character they were interested in me playing, and became deeply fascinated by this beautiful Black woman who was in her 60s, but looked like she was in her 30s, and who is a legend in the fitness industry, a living legend. And I had the pleasure of meeting her. She trained me one morning. Then we had a 4-hour lunch where she told me her life story, which is riveting. And I trained with her for a few more sessions. And she's an incredible person. I hope people look into Casey Duke and find out more about her. People should know who she is.
Is it hard to get trained by someone you're playing? Like, it's hard. Is it hard to be like, oh, no, this is too hard? Like, you know, I can only imagine the stress of like having someone you're playing and someone you're embodying train you and you struggling with it or something like that?
You know, Casey was, she meets you where you are. Like in my workout sessions with her, she met me where I was in terms of my fitness. She sort of gives you an assessment. She asks you what you'd like for your body, you know, and her whole philosophy is you have to love the body you have to get the body you want. And then she sort of, you know, tells you, well, I see for you, you know, we could maybe tone up here or whatever, but this looks great and let's embrace this. So she's very loving and gentle. But then like, and the workout is challenging for sure, but it didn't feel like it was crazy. But the next day I was so sore, everything like her, I woke up and I was like, oh my God. So it is.
What is the craziest part of this whole Anna Delvey story to you?
I think what still is fascinating, most fascinating to me, is that she faked financial documents and assets, got in advance, a $200,000 advance on a loan for $40 million, and was inches close to actually getting the $40 million loan. And you know what, when I read that piece of it, I believe at the time, it seems like at the time, Michael Cohen, former president's former lawyer, was testifying before Congress about, you know, the 45th president of the United States, you know, inflating assets, you know, to get loans and deflating them when it came time to pay taxes and faking financial documents. And so I was just intrigued by this, you know, sort of woman who comes here as an immigrant with the American dream, you know, doing something that the president of the United States allegedly was also doing. And so I found that really, I continue to find that really fascinating. And it makes me think about accountability, who gets to, who pays for their corrupt and illegal activities and who doesn't. And it's just so many interesting things. But that to me, that she was this close to actually getting a $40 million loan, it still blows my mind. Still blows my mind.
What blows my mind about the story is, I mean, I guess let's talk about your character for just for a second. You know, like you mentioned, Casey, real life celebrity trainer, life coach, was part of Anna's inner sanctum before she found out the truth.
Mm-hmm. Anna Delvey doesn't exist. That person in Rikers is somebody else, somebody who was pretending to be Anna Delvey. We don't know her. You don't know anything about her.
She's Anna.
She may be your friend, Anna, or she may be a total stranger. Do you really want to go down there, walk into that prison, and find out the person you thought was one of your closest friends was just a made-up character?
What I found interesting about this, and you might have to help me with this a little bit, is just how attractive celebrity and glamour is to us unconditionally. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. You know, when I read about Anna's story initially, it made me think about my early days in New York City in the 90s. When I moved to New York in 1993 and was the height of the sort of club kid craze, and everyone kind of partied together. Clubs were very integrated in the 90s and the early 2000s. And so you could be at, you know, Limelight and, you know, Jean-Paul Gaultier might be, you know, standing right next to you or something. And when I just remember during the early 2000s, being in a club called Lot 61, Amy Sacco's, you know, club at the time, she would open Bungalow 8, which was famously talked about in Sex and the City, which a club I also used to go to. But I remember being at Lot 61. I was a waitress at the time, aspiring actress. This was 2000, around the year 1999, 2000. And Leonardo DiCaprio was 2 feet away from me.
Wow.
He hung out with David Blaine and Elijah Wood from, you know, The Ring, Lord of the Rings.
The Lord of the Rings, yeah. And one of the guys from Entourage, right? Like, he was there?
I don't remember one of the guys from Entourage being there, but I remember Elijah and David Blaine and Leonardo. And there were about, you know, 12 to 20 women who all could be Victoria's Secret models, you know, sort of, you know, surrounding them. You know, I saw this live, you know, so this was kind of my life. And I remember in the late 90s and early 2000s, in proximity to Leonardo DiCaprio, feeling so utterly and completely fabulous because I was 2 feet away from Leonardo DiCaprio in the same club. And it made me feel so fabulous. And like, I was kind of, I was somebody, even as I went back to my studio apartment on the Upper West Side, where I could reach out either arm and touch the wall while, you know, stick out my arms and touch either wall. And the bathroom was in the hall, you know, and I was living in these very, you know, I was a poor waitress living, you know, in this studio apartment with the bathroom in the hall. But I felt so fabulous because I was in the same room with this celebrity, you know, and I've luckily outgrown that with age. But there was so when I read Anna's story, I thought about that time in my life and certain people who, particularly when you're young or when you're in your 20s or maybe even 30s, when you're just so fascinated and enamored by fame and enamored by money and glamour, that you could sort of be sucked into all that. And luckily I've outgrown that.
Well, also you touched it yourself. I mean, you've become famous and influential yourself. And I bet there's a part of you that's like, really, this is it? Like, I'm not sure you're grateful.
There was a moment. So in 2013, I had a friend. I went to an Interview magazine party. A friend of mine worked at Interview magazine. We'd known each other for years. And yeah. It was 2013, and it was the September issue of Interview magazine. All the supermodels, you know, several different covers with the supermodels, you know, the Naomi's, right, and et cetera. Right. And I go to the door. I was thinking his name was Guyton. And I go to the, you know, the velvet rope. And I'm like, hey, Guyton, how you doing? And Guyton's like, it's crazy tonight. Everybody's here. I don't know if I'll be able to get you in. And I was just like, Guyton, it's okay. It's all cool. Now, this was September 2013. Orange is the New Black was out for a few months. And Guyton and I have been friends for years. And Guyton would get me into, you know, various parties. You know, this is how you, in New York, you have friends who get you into these exclusive parties. But this one, he didn't think he'd be able to get me into. His boss comes out, recognizes me from Orange is the New Black, and says, oh my God, it's Laverne. And then says, Guyton. And then they let me right in. And then they put me at this table. I'm by myself. And they put me at this table with like a bottle of like, you know, champagne or something. So I'm at this banquet with this bottle of champagne alone because all of a sudden, you know, things have shifted. And I remember being at the party and looking around and seeing all of these people, young people who felt like I did a decade earlier, fabulous because they were in the same room with all these supermodels and felt fabulous. And I was kind of over it. You know, this is like, you know, 41-year-old Laverne, who was just kind of like, I wasn't enamored by it. And this is before, you know, the show would come out, but I hadn't blown up or anything. At least I didn't think I had. And so I grew out of that even before, you know, sort of, I guess I entered some more elite circles.
I gotta say, I'm a sucker for those like overnight fame stories. Not the stories of like when you become famous overnight, but like when something clicks and people just treat you differently overnight. So great to talk to Laverne Cox. More from Laverne Cox, including her story of being on Wheel of Fortune after this. I hope you enjoy whatever product, service, advertisement, album, whatever was just advertised. Hope you dug it. Hope it was at least entertaining. I want to remind you before we get into our interview, if you want to get in touch with me, the best way to do that is on Instagram. I'm at Tom Joe Power. You can also email the show q@cbc.ca. Here's more with Laverne Cox. You mentioned off the top that you got to work with Shonda Rhimes on this. You know, this show was created by Shonda Rhimes, who, of course, is an icon. She wrote the entire series. She's worked on shows like Grey's Anatomy, Scandal, How to Get Away with Murder. She also produces your podcast, The Laverne Cox Show.
Yeah.
What's the biggest thing you've learned from working with her?
Oh, well, I mean, I think she's a genius. I think that thing that makes you want to tune into the next episode on Netflix to click and watch the next episode immediately. I've watched the entire series. Like, I feel like that is just, it seems maybe over all these years, it just seems like this innate thing that she just is able to construct a story, even out of real events where you're sort of just like gasping and oohing and aahing and can't believe it as you watch it, or even as you read it at table reads, I was gasping and like, and you know, and just like, oh my God, and like shrieking just, you know, as I read, you know, the scripts. And then I felt the same way watching it. But after a table read, I would when we would get new scripts and rewrites, what was interesting and fascinating to me is that how much she was interested in getting to the truth of the story, the truth of what is this story really about? Who are these characters really? There's all of the things that make you wanna, you know, turn the page or click on the next episode or like sit on the edge of your seat during a commercial break if it was Scandal back in the day. All that stuff is just, it's there. It's gonna be there in a Shonda Rhimes project. But then the truth of the story, and that brings up all of these questions that she doesn't give you answers for, but it sparks conversation about accountability for me, this show, about, you know, faking it, about feeling like you're enough, about transactional relationships. There are all these questions that she kind of gets to the heart of, but doesn't like tell you what to think, invites you as a viewer to have conversation. And that is something that evolved in the scripts as they would come through after table reads, after she would hear it, you know. And then in the pandemic, we had some time off, you know, we had a break in shooting. And then coming back and seeing that she had refined the story even more and whittled it down to like what she believed was the essence of what the story was about. That was, and that she is so relentlessly in search of that, right? That she doesn't feel like she's got it and she's done, but that there's a pursuit in terms of creative process to get to the truth of the story. That was, and how relentless she is about that. That was, I think, the biggest thing that I learned, that like that process is never really done as an artist.
I'm struck by the fact that you keep on mentioning the idea of getting to the truth of the story, the truth of the story, the truth of the story. When you're playing somebody who was a real person, as you are in the show, how do you balance the truth of the responsibility of this is a real person, and it's a person you've met and a person who you trained with, and the truth of a performance as an actor?
There is what is on the page that Shonda has written and the story that Shonda wants to tell that may or may not fully align with who, you know, Casey is in real life. And so my job as an actor is to tell the story that Shonda has written. But what is possible for me with Casey, just getting, you know, hearing her life story. She was very generous and very vulnerable with me. And there's many aspects of her personal story that I deeply connected with. And so that became easy. But then there were questions I had around sort of the mantras, you know, how positive Casey is and how, you know, inspiring she is. And there's a part of me that's very sort of skeptical about all that. And I went to, and then I remember she told me she was did fitness competitions when she was younger. And I was like, to be 65 years old and in the shape that she's in, Casey's an elite athlete and she has this mentality of an elite athlete. And so I was like, I should go to a sports psychologist and have a conversation with them about what that mindset is. And so for me, it's about how do you layer in all of that knowledge of what I've determined to be Casey's. These are what the questions I ask as an actor. So all these things can be percolating the truth of who you are, your vulnerabilities and insecurities as you are doing this job, as you are fulfilling the objectives of a scene or a script. And so that is our job as actors to have. So the truth of humanity, the things that we all share in common as human beings is what is my job to get to and to have live in every scene, even as I'm also trying to tell the story that Shonda has put on the page. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and it's really spectacular. And it reminds me of the podcast in some ways. And I'm not just being coy here. Uh-huh. I'm not just being a good host segue dude here. But
that's a good segue though. But how did it remind you of the podcast?
Because the podcast for me is about learning.
Yeah.
It's about learning more about who you are. It's learning more about the people who surrounded you and help you to get to where you are. Mm-hmm. It's about learning about those unfulfilled needs and how to get them out. And that's something that's definitely been on my mind a lot during the pandemic and I've done a lot of work on. I learned something about you listening to the podcast. I actually isolated a little bit of a clip. This is of you talking to Billy Porter. Mm. I wanted to play it. Just take a listen to this.
I'm an artist who believes that art is activism, whether you want it to be or not.
Amen.
Art is activism, whether you want it to be or not. And I wanted to keep the amen in there.
Yeah.
Because did you know that being an actor who's transgender or not, would you would also be an activist?
Yes. I mean, in very specific terms, I was an activist before I sort of blew up.
Yeah.
You know, there's a good bit of documentation of me, you know, at Equality and Justice Days in Albany, going to talk to legislators, you know, making speeches about trans representation. I mean, there's a, even before I was, you know, known to the world. But I, you know, when we try to get to the truth of humanity, then hopefully we will inspire in the audience questions about their own lives so that they can live differently, think differently, be differently. And so what we do as actors is create empathy, hopefully. And that is particularly at this time in the world, empathy is activism because we have such a difficulty because, you know, empathy, it does not play well in the algorithm, right? Yeah. Empathy is not something that generates dollars and clicks. And so in a world where corporate interest, so media interest, politicians are very more invested in understanding that they can make more money in dividing us and having us at each other's throats, anything that is creating empathy is activism and is revolutionary and is really what we need. And art is that thing, and particularly storytelling is that thing. So yeah, it's always activism.
Empathy is not rewarded by the algorithm. I think I'm going to get that tattooed on my head and just...
It's a sad reality. I wish that weren't the case, but like, you know, Facebook, you know, the leaker, I guess they, you know, we have seen that like there's hard data, you know, that sort of supports that contention, right? That like the things that get more clicks tend to be things that create conflict and that are also lean into conspiracy theory, et cetera.
Yeah. That, listen, it's been so lovely to talk to you.
Yeah.
I want to play you one thing.
Okay.
I didn't want to leave, and I'm going a little bit overboard, but I just want to play you this one thing. Take a listen to
this.
Gagging, I'm on the iconic set. It's like, I'm gagging. 8-year-old me's dreams have come true, and they have really good lighting here.
That's you on Wheel of Fortune. What's it like to be on Wheel of Fortune?
I did not expect to have this reaction. Can I tell you, I did not expect to have this reaction. I was very surprised, and even watching the video, I was like, this is a little cringe. Like, I'm crying. At the end, I was like, this is a little cringe. I was crying because I just met Vanna White. But I think what happens, you know, I've done a lot of work on the nervous system and trauma. Like, trauma lives in the nervous system, but all kinds of things live in our nervous systems, right? And so there was something about that happened once I stepped on the set of Wheel of Fortune, because I had met Vanna White before, but being on the set of Wheel of Fortune with Vanna White and Pat Sajak, all of a sudden there was a physical memory in my body, a sensation in my body that took me back. And I could cry right now thinking about being, oh my goodness, wow. At home with my mom and my brother watching Wheel of Fortune, trying to solve puzzles and feeling a sense of family and feeling a sense of love and connection with my brother and my mother that, like, you know, felt like us, and it felt comforting and it felt awesome. And it was just like this really beautiful memory during these formative years. And so it's great. That's what's crazy. You know, I, on my podcast, I say that, you know, the body doesn't know if a trauma happened 10 or 20 years ago once you're triggered, but like, it also doesn't know if something good, you know, happened 10 or 20 years ago. So it's almost like you can transport yourself. And this is a great thing about being an actor too. You can transport yourself. The nervous system is this very interesting thing. So just being on the set of Wheel of Fortune was like, oh my God, like I, all this great sensations of like my family and feeling love, you know, I didn't always feel love, I guess, as a kid, but there was something about those moments watching television with my mother and my brother where there was us coming together where I felt love. Oh my goodness, that's really what it is. And a TV show can evoke that apparently.
Oh, that's absolutely beautiful. Listen, what a joy to talk to you today. I could talk to you forever, but I know you got, I know you have a, I think I see 4,000 more interviews you have to do today.
Something like that, so 4,001.
Thank you so much. We're such fans of yours.
Thank you.
And take care.
I appreciate it. Have a great day.
All right, so let me just say this. In case you were wondering how Laverne actually did on Celebrity Wheel of Fortune, she raised $34,600 for the charity of her choice, which was the Trans Justice Funding Project. Laverne Cox plays the real-life celebrity personal trainer Casey Duke in the new Netflix series Inventing Anna, which is produced and written by Shonda Rhimes. Her podcast is called The Laverne Cox Show. I've been asked if I, on this podcast, if I can respond to a little bit of mail that we've been getting, and I thought I would. I'm not going to say who this one was from, but it's a real letter. You can hear my phone. That's the sound of me tapping my phone. Real email. Dear Mr. Power, I often enjoy your show and noted a few times that you've mentioned eating peanut butter out of the jar, which makes me grimace in reaction to this. To be clear, this is not out of distaste or disgust at your eating peanut butter out of the jar, but more because you seem like an embarrassed rookie when you admit to it. Take it from an eater of peanut butter out of the jar for over 50 years that there is nothing wrong or shameful about this. In fact, it is a wonderful way to have a quick meal on the go or on the couch with no preparation required. To really perk things up, I suggest you add chocolate chips to the jar of peanut butter, as many as you wish, and use a tablespoon. So right off the bat, I don't think I've ever mentioned eating peanut butter out of it. I'm not adverse to it. I do eat a lot of peanut butter. I switched from the store, you know, like the Kraft crunchy peanut butter. I switched to the natural peanut butter as part of my New Year's resolution. Really been enjoying that. I'm not one to put the spoon in there and just go for it, I tell you that much. So while I appreciate your note, anonymous emailer, but you know what? Here's what I do like about this email. There's some acceptance of who we are. You know, it's not a snobby email. And it's not someone, you know, God knows I've gotten a lot of emails that probably would have been like, how dare you? How dare you eat peanut butter out of a jar? You know what? Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Maybe when I get home, I will take the tablespoon out, get the chocolate chips, and have myself a nice dishes-free treat. If you want to send me an email, q@cbc.ca, or find me on Instagram at Tom Joe Power. That is it for the show. We'll see you next week. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.